Thanks, Dean. I'm Nick. I'm an addict. I always want to commence this really cool and just being here and being present and being cool. But there always comes a point where whatever it is that functional denial starts to erode, and it was somewhere during the readings and when you were reading the traditions. It just feels like that moment where you've had so much coke you have to tear your shirt off your back. You know that thing where you're sort of standing up and your clothes are rustling, it's winter flowing through. Well, that, like primary school where someone says, oh, you've had it, I'm going to get you outside. You go, really? But you feel that quickening, you know, and that sense of, oh, hey, up, here we go, you know. And I think for me this thing of ours has unleashed me. It's given me a voice. It's given me an ability to be in the world unshadowed, you know, to be able to say who I am, you know, without walking down, you know, that desire to explain ourselves and walk around like some Uriah Heep deferential, touching my forelock and who's sorry and all that kind of, all the reasons that forced me, you described it really well, that abyss of that hole of that unhappiness, that place. I don't want to be incoherent about it, but been thinking about it a lot lately, and this is the only place I've felt this stuff, and it's the only thing that I've ever seen work. And I've seen lots of different things and different approaches to addiction and all the rest of it, and for some reason, and it's not down to me, do you know what I mean? It's not an intellectual program, it's just this surrender lark. And, you know, I remember I came in through, I went to a few meetings. My wife got clean before me in meetings. And I watched her. She'd get clean, then I'd give her some codeine linters to help her out. You know, stuff like that, because I didn't understand total abstinence. I had no understanding of it. And eventually I went to a couple of meetings. And I think I went to a meeting originally to get the family allowance book, which was 14 quid. That was the level of my using. It was things like that. I'd go and get, you know, I'd get my script and I'd get a gram of speed. Occasionally the woman would give me some cocaine, you know, and that was the sort of level of it. When I went into treatment, you know, they say, what's your drug of choice? I said, cocaine and heroin. And the guy had the guy unfortunately said to me, when did you last use cocaine? You know, and it was like, I mean, how dare you question my fucking whatever, you know, my truth. But the reality was, near the end of my using, even gear, if I got a £10 bag, the only thing that worked about it was the withdrawal bit. Do you know what I mean? that was the bit, there was a constant thread throughout my using was, you could always withdraw, but the rest of it, the kind of, the blissful nodding out and the sense of feeling free in the world, mostly it was just the withdrawal bit and the sweaty bit, you know. And I never expected to be free of that, you know. I could never have imagined, I mean, you know when people talk about I was using £1,000 a day and all that. Well, at the end of my using, mine was like about, I was getting codeine linters on credit from the chemist around the corner, and I'd pay my bill on Saturday to be like 8 quid or something like that. That was the level of my using for a week. Methadone script of like 20 mils, you know, something like that, 30 mils or something like that. I used to go and get this good North London industrial speed, and another thing where every opiate user knows, I mean, I've said this before, but I'll just say it really quickly. Walking in Liverpool on a bank holiday, waiting for the chemist to open to get my methadone. And the whole, I was like something, that, you know those things you see on the beach that are really dry, which look like bleached in the middle of the desert? That's how I felt. There was no trace of opiates left in my body or opioids. It'd been 4 days without anything. So I was walking in that kind of linear, focused fashion to the chemist. Didn't even have bus fare. As I was walking along, some guy in Liverpool 8 just appeared next to me and said, do you want any speed, la? Now, every opiate user since the world began knows that if you're withdrawing from opiates, the best thing you can possibly do is inject amphetamine. You know, it's just fucking mad. And it was one of those moments where I just went, is it free? You know, can you lay it on me? And he went, yeah. And next thing, I'm not going to do it because I've told this tale so often, and it is a bit of a tale, so I'm going to pass on it. But, I'm going to truncate it. Understandably, when the guy offered me to lay the speed on me, I just said, yeah. Next thing, I'm getting into a half-demolished house, some big, decayed Georgian mansion on Princess Avenue that was based on Paris. It's that kind of, the same architect designer. So with these huge Gothic mansions, I've pulled corrugated iron back. I'm in the house, I'm looking for water. There's no water in the house at all to have a hit. So I've got me 2 mil, I've got a boiler suit on. I've got I thought all those pockets, I thought it was designed for addicts, you know, that's all secret pockets and screwdriver pockets and all this. I get the 2 mil out, there's no water in the house, so I think, fuck it, I'm going to have it in my groin anyway. I'll just hit it dry. I'll draw blood back. That's a way of doing it. I think I'll send this into Blue Peter afterwards. They'll say, if you're ever stuck in a bombed house, you know. So this is what I do. So I have this hit in my groin with this gram of speed. I'm really withdrawing. There's just a rhombus of sunlight around the corrugated iron. I'm standing in the middle of this deserted mansion. And there's that moment where, you know, there's a moment when it starts coming on. There's a warmth that spreads up somewhere from your groin and hits the heart and then goes through the body where, and there's suddenly I'm drenched in sweat and my clothes are stuck to me, my boiler suit sort of, and at this, and I'm thinking, however bad it was before when I was on Princess Avenue going to get me a script, I wish it was back in those days, you know. 35 seconds ago, it was much better in those days, you know. You could leave your front door open, it was great then, you know. So it was that kind of mad. Suddenly I was transported into this inner circle of the inferno, this Dantean fucking reality. And of course, being amphetamine and being withdrawing, the next thing is I have to have a shit, right? No, not a kind of discussion about it or to get to anywhere. I just drop the boiler suit and practically lift off the floor, you know, and just evacuate on this floor in this house. And I'm crouched like some kind of beast. By this time, I've lost all shred of humanity. And I finish, and I look around, there's no paper, and I've got some curtains from the Blitz, and I thought, a Park Drive packet from 1954, you know, like it's dead sharp and edgy, and got bird shit on it. It's like, I'm like Gollum, you know, in this cave. You know. And I kind of do the best I can, and then I think, okay. And you know that wonderful denial we've got, the way we can forget things very quickly in addiction, go, so forget that whole chapter, and we'll move on. You know, I'll go back onto the street. And I put my arms in the boiler suit. I flicked the boiler suit up, and I felt this big splat. And that was the upside of my using. No, no. And the thing then was, I had a choice. I had this terrible choice. I did what I could in this house, and I thought to clean myself up. And I came out, you know, blinking into the sunlight. And by that time, the pain is so great. It's just I was just some kind of prehistoric creature, sort of on the edge of the boulevard. And I knew I had a choice. I could either go back to my house and get cleaned up, which was 200 yards that way, or I could carry on and just go into denial and go to the chemist, which was 2 miles that way. It's a pretty easy decision to make, you know, so I carried on. And as I walked into Liverpool, into the centre of Liverpool, people were actually drawing away from me, you know, I was walking in. It was the only time I went into the chemist in boots and went up to the pharmacy, and they served me very quickly. Normally you'd be some exiled leper, you know, on the edge of society, but this day the guy was there, and I was out. I had that 50 mils of methadone. This is the level of mine, as I say. I drank that 50 mils, and it was as though my whole body, it was almost like a religious experience standing outside the chemist in the middle of Liverpool and feeling it coming on, and just feeling my whole, every molecular, psychic kind of, all those bits coming back home to roost. You know that kind of thing, someone's knocking at the door. All those parts of myself, I reassembled. It was like some molecular reassembling and condensation, and suddenly I appeared, and I was back, and I materialized in the street, and I thought, this is, it doesn't get any better than this. You know? I couldn't even smell the shit anymore. You know what I mean? Somebody said, I said to the dealer once, I said, you know that thing when you're sweaty for days and days withdrawing, you stink, and it's that ammonia, sort of awful cat's piss, almost viscous, you can feel it, you know. As soon as you have a hit, it goes away. Does it really go away? Or do we just think it does? He went, oh no, it really goes away. You know, in that kind of innocence, that fairy tale world of... Anyway, I said I wouldn't do that, and I you can't help but think of these things. And I was really keen on in a sense, not being irreverent about this or making light of it. Because when I was in a treatment center, I had a day clean in there. You know, I went in, as I say, I was on a small methadone script, detox, quick detox, 8 days, some kind of quick half-life benzos, oxazepam, and you know, no methadone. And that was it. That was my detox and a couple of beta blockers. And on the first day, I had nothing. I was almost euphoric. I thought, God, you know, I'm clean by choice. You know, for the first time in my adult, I was 37 years old, and it was like I'd never been clean before. Whenever, even if it was a kind of special brew, you know what I mean? It didn't matter what it was, or I would have to take something because reality was too uncomfortable. Even in a sense that, that's with the speed. You know, you're going to feel worse after it, but feeling worse is at least an engagement. You know, It's like paranoia. It's like good paranoia, where there's something about it which is better to be followed and chased and pursued than ignored. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And be left to free fall in the world. And that was the first day. As I say, I was on this euphoric high. I was clean. I was free for the first time in my life. The second day, all my stuff cut in. I couldn't look people in the eyes. My pupils were dilated. I was sweaty. And I went to the medical center in the treatment center, and I said, I need something to sort me out, you know, and they just held their line. They just said, well, you don't, you know. And that real demonic flicker of the addict, the way it switches quickly. So what, one minute I'm really deferential, you know, oh, please, you must understand, and I'm a grammar school boy, and I'm, you know, okay, really, and all that nonsense. But then next thing I'm banging on the door, fucking give me, you know, that quick, threatening. And they were unmoved by any of my kind of, you know, stuff. And in the end, they got another guy in the treatment centre. He was 3 weeks clean. He's still around now. And he came in to me. He said, what's happening? And I told him. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, you know, parts of your brain are opening up. You've been using opiates for years and years. And there's all this stuff going on, and the physiological things and that. And whatever the truth of what he said was, what he also said within all that was, he said, I was the same 3 weeks ago. And he was still there. And that was the moment for me. It was just that he was still there. And that's the old therapeutic value for me, of one addict helping another. It's, in a sense, that's why I said to you earlier on about the message of recovery is, it's not the content necessarily. It's not someone persuading you by their rhetoric. It's something about the presence of it, you know, and the being there, being in the world. And immediately my withdrawals kind of subsided. They didn't go away entirely, but suddenly they were just what you'd expect. You know, they were mild physical withdrawals. They weren't some circle of the inferno or whatever addressed them. They weren't a fate worse than death or the end of all existence as we know it. It was just mild withdrawal. And, you know, for months after that, I occasionally wake up and feel like I was withdrawing from methadone, but it lost its power. You know, it lost. And I knew that thing that we all know in this room sooner or later, what you're saying about keeping coming back, is that all things must pass. You know, this stuff passes. And just to give you an example, this is sort of 29 years in. The other day, my wife's been very ill for a couple of years. Well, not for a couple of years. Let me get this right. My wife was diagnosed with leukemia in 2010. And it just, it was like the worst thing that could possibly happen to us. We thought she was going to die. She was given an 8% chance of survival with the comorbidity with Hep C and all the rest of it. And she had acute myeloid leukemia. We were ambushed with it. She was very successful, working therapist, family therapist, doing all this sort of stuff, social worker. And suddenly all that went, you know. And she was in hospital receiving chemo and hoping that they could find a transplant for her, a match, which they did do. It was successful. That was 7 years ago. And it just got better. And then last May, we were ambushed again, and the leukemia came back. And then it was, you know, I thought it was bad the first time around, but the second time around, I was working, I had a successful practice, I had to let go of all my clients and just attend to the hospital. My wife got really ill, and her spirit was flattened. So you're seeing someone where it is just that bleakness. You know, I've spent my life, like a lot of addicts, listening to Mahler, romantic poetry, half in love with easeful death, as Keats would say. Was it Keats? I think it's Keats, yeah. Half in love with easeful death. And that, the romance of it, and the gothic romance. But the reality was a different thing. The reality was a fucking flat, domestic, unyielding, bleak, diurnal grind of each day going to that hospital, beyond thought, you know, just labouring along to the hospital, going in, my wife getting sicker and sicker, not even able to speak. And as I say, I don't want to kind of, and I always do this impressionistic ramble, so bear with me. But we were totally ambushed anyway. You know, we were in a state of shock. And what happened was, she had chemo this time around in May, and it didn't work, so the leukemia was still there. And then they had a match, they'd found a match for, 100% match of an anonymous donor for August. And then suddenly, you know, they didn't have that kind of time anymore. So they did a related match, a related donor, which is a 50% match from my son, who's also in recovery. So, I mean, you couldn't write this stuff. But the good thing was, at one time, that was a last-ditch thing, doing that. It was usually a prelude to death, and it would give you a little bit longer, but it seldom kind of worked. But in the last 3 or 4 years, they've had amazing success with these 50% related donor transplants. There's lots of advantages to them. And like a lot of this stuff, you talk about the NHS, I mean, sometimes they're housekeeping shite, but when you get down to that stuff and that level of stuff they do, there's something about it, it's kind of beyond sentiment, you know, and the sort of level they're working at and stuff like that. And the consultant there was a champion of this kind of transplant, and he said, she'll be all right. You know, and you know what I mean? And these are guys, and I remember the last time, 7 years ago, you can imagine, we got bombarded with people in the fellowship and everywhere else who said, have you tried aromatherapy? Or, you know what I mean? or, you know, maybe meditation, or perhaps it's your karma. You know, all that kind of stuff that's really helpful when you're in that situation. And, you know, and when I looked, I did all the research, and there are lots of people around who said they could cure cancer. And there were blogs of people who cured it themselves, or they'd use the Gerson method with juicing and all this sort of stuff. And the blogs petered out because they died. And this is my kind of, my skepticism around this stuff. But the difference was, there were people on there, kind of complementary therapists. That was a different thing. The guy welcomed complementary therapy. We had lots of that. But the ones who said, oh no, it's, you know, it's, we can do it. They were sure. When I said this to the consultants said, we're not sure. And there was something about the humility of that. We don't know what's going to happen. To this day, the consultant says, look, we're anxious too. We don't know where Sue's going to live or die. And there's something about that that's incredibly liberating and feels better than the bullshit, really, and the sureness. And it's a bit like this thing with us, you know, and I don't really know after all these years. My suspicion, I've got no theories about recovery, but what I know is when I come into one of these rooms and sit with you, I'm normally an isolate character. I find difficult making eye contact. I have difficulty. I've always been kind of shy and awkward and, you know, embarrassed and judgmental and all those things that we all are. Somehow in this room with you, for a time, I'm freed of that. You know, I'm shrived. I'm kind of cleansed of that stuff. And when I leave here, I feel saner and I feel more grounded. I feel more physical, connected to the earth and all that. And all my, you know, florid nonsense is disappears from it or subsides, you know, and I feel very connected to the to life. And it is, you know, it's this surrender. There's something about it. And it is a gift, you know. I mean, I was lucky, I came in and I kind of, well, my first sponsor, he wasn't a great doer of the steps. We did the steps, but he did them, his sponsor kind of half did them, you know, and all that. So it was back, this is, as I say, 30 years ago. And but we were clean and we enjoyed being in recovery, and we've talked about, because he's not like, you know, he's the guy still around now, and we've all had different sponsors, and we've, you know, I have, my sponsor at the moment is very formal, but he's become a friend over the years, but we did the steps in a formal manner and all the rest of it. And he said, the thing with us, and this is what I would extend to people coming in as well, is that we were relieved. We knew we'd had a result being in these rooms, you know, just to be free of that desire to use was just beyond my wildest dreams. You know, it was just an impossibility, you know, on a daily basis. And so that, it's something about that. And in a sense, it's why I don't really, working in treatment centers and stuff like that, you know, I'd often try to kind of browbeat people into being in, but you can't. You know, it's always an inside job, this. There's something about it. And when conditions are propitious, we connect. You know, there's something about it, and something happens to us, and suddenly we're here and we connect. And then it's a piece of piss. You know, I know it's hard and recovery is difficult. And I've had all kinds of terrible things in recovery, mostly which I've been the author of, you know, things that are, not things that have fallen, not like my you know, the illness and that. And the irony is, I don't want to go, my wife's fine at the moment, by the way, just to draw a line under that. She had the transplant, it worked. She's fine, she's fatigued, there's a slow recovery process, but she's been out to the park with me, she's home, you know, she's been in hospital for a long time. I'd also surrendered a few years ago. We'd got a dog. I've always resisted having a dog. We've always had cats. And, you know, the thought of arsing about with a dog and the trouble it would be. This dog is like, it's, you know, you couldn't buy that kind of therapy. This dog, it's in the bed with us every night. I was saying to someone earlier, I wake up at night and I'm freezing. Part of me is sweating, because it's, but the rest of me, which is bare outside the duvet, there's a cat wedged between my legs. There's the dog's sort of horizontal with his paws are like mahogany sort of chair legs or something stuck in my face like that. And I'm sort of, you know, this creep there. But it's great. You know, it feels like it's an end of loneliness. It feels like life. My wife's there in the bed, and it, it, it just feels great. So she's fine, you know, inshallah, by the grace of God, whatever, you know, by and this prog, you know, this is what's allowed me to support her in that. But it's, I mean, it's the funny bit of it. It didn't feel funny at the time. I had to buy a car while she was in the hospital, and I was kind of rushed, and she said, don't do what you normally do and get some, you know, hippie, don't go and find one somewhere, do a proper thing, you know. So I went to Car Giant and bought this, the worst car you could imagine, this sort of straight kind of, it feels like your dad or something, that's not fair, but you know, it feels like some other generation thing. It's a real utilitarian thing. And I did all the research and thought, well, it's built by, it's actually the research is that, even though it's called this, you know, and all that kind of thing. But when I'm sitting in it, I feel like a geek, you know what I mean? I'm sitting in this car and it's, but it works and it does the trick and everything. But the other day, I left the lights on, so I came out and the battery was flat. And immediately, you know all those voices, that big chorus of voices, they're all these years of, you know, sort of, letting go of all your stuff and, you know, having our defects removed and all that. But it's amazing how they don't go that far. Someone said to me, what it is, he said, instead of, he said, they're still there, he said, but they're tied up and they're gagged and tied in the room back there shouting, you can't. it's muffled, but, and they wait for those kind of, like, leaving the lights on the car, what did you do that for, you stupid? You might as well give up, you might as well hang yourself, you know, it's the end of everything. And, but, it's amazing the viciousness and the pain of that stuff. And if you're telling anybody, you go, what? You've got a flat back. Why don't you just charge the battery, you know? And then I went to get the battery out, and it looked like something out of Alien. It was encrusted with electronics and complex. And then I felt, you know, like some miserable old colonel going, in my day, you could take the battery out. So I had to run a cable across over the pavement, you know, and drop it down over a road sign and trickle charge it in go to Argos and buy a trickle, you know, this stuff. And... What the reason I'm saying it is the incongruence between the actual event, the reality, the factual reality of it, and what went on for me in this. Oh no! What, I imagine the neighbours saying, "Look what he's done! You know, it's outrageous! You know, he's like a total failure! You know." And of course, I charged it for a few hours. It worked, and then coming out of Waitrose the other day, I banged it into reverse to do a 3-point turn, but I banged it into second, so I lurched forward and smashed into the kerb. And it was a minor thing. I drove home, it was fine and all. I was expecting to see the whole front crumpled in. There was nothing, but one of the tyres was flat the next day, you know, so it went down. So, and I was just, I've got a flat tyre, you know, and I've got no spare because they don't give you the spare now and all that sort of stuff. You know, I rang up some local tyre place this morning. It was done in half an hour. You know, it was all, as I say, the disparity between the reality, but what goes on, that storm. And I think that's why, I don't think that's ever going to go. And I know, because I didn't go to many meetings over Christmas, that unmanageability creeps back in. You know, if I don't come here and I get frustrated, I'm torn between self-pity and murderous homicidal rage. It's usually and they've got it in for me. You know, it's infamy. You know, there's all those feelings go on. And I come here and suddenly it's not that big a deal. It's just what it is rather than all the you know, intergenerational, historical, back to... into the mists of antiquity nonsense that usually goes off for me. But just, is it time? Sounded like Beckett then, you know, end game. Is it time for my medication? Yes. Can I have it, please? It's gone. Ah! Yeah, I mean, look, this is the best thing that ever happened to me, without a doubt. And it's sort of, as far as I'm concerned, it's not really about giving you a message. If you're in the room, you're here. It's that simple. You got it, and that's my, the only thing I've done repeatedly in recovery is come to meetings, occasionally done a bit of service. I've got sponsees, I've got a sponsor, I've got a good sponsor. That's been essential right from back in the day. My first sponsor, I used to ring them up 4 or 5 times a day, and it'd be things like, I'd say like, I'm in a crisis of existential angst and I don't know how to continue. He'd say, have you had a wash? You know, stuff like that. I'd go, I'd be really indignant. You know, it's much higher than that, my predicament. It's much, you know. And usually it was that I'd have a wash or a shave or I'd clean the cat litter tray and suddenly I'd wash the dishes. But you know that thing in early recovery where even having you're trying to roll a ciggy and then you're trying to get your shirt on and fasten the button and you're, fucking hell. Oh, I can't do it, man. It's like going to the gym, you know, when you're, if you haven't been to the gym for a while, and there's incredible pain involved, but you need someone standing there who goes, look, trust me, you won't die, it's okay, just keep doing it. And in a sense, when I come here, you guys carry me with that thing, and I know that it just changes, you know, my perspective on things changes. And I used to say about sponsees, the good thing about sponsees is you have to have your wits about you, because otherwise you get found out, you know what I mean? So you have to do the stuff so that you can. But again, with all my thing with recovery is that, because when I came around, there were lots of people who were around, they were clean, they were, you know, but they weren't really doing the stuff. This isn't a judgment. I'm just saying how it was with it, and that's always been the case. But they fell by the wayside, or they did the stuff, was my experience. And sooner or later, and for me, it wasn't in treatment. You know, imagine a treatment centre, you whizzing through, do step 4 and 5, do all that, they got somebody in to do it and all that. And whatever the way, it was like a mad confessional for me, you know, sort of sexual inappropriateness, all that, all the stuff that where you walk along the street and you feel okay, then you remember something you've done and go, you know. I need to go to London Zoo and surrender myself and ask for a cage for the night. And a lot of that stuff, of course, when you get it out, it's not that big a deal. It's minor stuff, you know, trivia. Because usually the person who remembers it is the child. You know, it's still locked back in the 8-year-old child or the 11-year-old or whatever, and it seems enormous to them. But you get it out in an adult place and suddenly it isn't. And I sort of want to avoid it, but I think it's important to write things down. I think writing the steps formally, there's something about that that brings it, because when I'm speaking like this, I can't really hear what I'm saying. You know what I mean? And also I'm watching body language, so I'll respond. We're very good at that. You know, we're good at reading rooms. And often, the reason we are is because we've been in very violent situations when we're younger. And you get very good then, you get very quick at being able to read rooms quickly. It's like when you're dealing and people come up to you and say, I've got a mate, can he come round and score off you? And you go, and they say, he's all right. And you go, let me have a look at him first, preferably away from the house, you know? And you get to meet them, and they're not all right, right? But because other people's interests are there. And I think this is what this restores us to, is we get our intuition back, you know? Because our intuition gets skewed when we're using, you know, because of the nature of the corruption of the addiction. And somehow we find ourselves again in these rooms. And, you know, as I say, I don't want to ramble on, but I think it's... And I mean this in a really compassionate way, because I'm the worst, you know. I didn't sort of come in and enthusiastically do the steps and work through them, but I did, you know. But mostly I did it through discomfort, when it felt difficult, because I have to be, you know, goaded into action. And whenever I've done that, and there's something about, it's not even the amount, there's something about really saying, this is a matter of life and death. This is total commitment, you know. I don't want to go back to that place like we were talking about earlier. And what have I got to lose? You know, include all of us in this room. I sometimes think of some of those things, like the speed in the empty house or whatever, and the brass neck of that walking in through town thinking, oh, people won't mind, you know what I mean? Whereas now in recovery, you're like, oh, I wonder what my shirt looks like, or, you know, and stuff like that. And it's that crippling self-obsession and narcissism. I sometimes wish I had some of that sort of barbiturate sensibility, you know, where you just switched off from the world around. I don't. I have to say, I don't wish that. I'd rather be walking around feeling embarrassed than have that back. But this is just my story. I don't feel like I've done that much in recovery, you know. I feel it's been very easy and very compassionate, and I think it's a really humane business. And what I've tried to do with sponsees, and I've got from my sponsor too. My sponsor's very, as I say, very formal. You had to go to 4 meetings a week, and that's what he does, and he's done it for, you know, 35 years. And I wasn't doing that. And instead of saying I'm not doing that, I said, I am doing that, right? And of course, it haunted me every time I spoke to him. So then I started to resent him for putting me in that position, even though he hadn't done anything, you know, the usual thing. I'm wanting to blame him. And then I came clean with him. And as soon as I came clean with him, he said, well, I'm not now anyway. I'm doing 3 meetings a week or something like that. But it's this challenge to honesty is a big deal for us. Because underneath all my fear of that stuff is usually the fear of being told off. It's a very childlike fear underneath, that I'll be embarrassed or told off, or, you know. And nobody's ever done that with me in recovery. That's what I want to say about these rooms and finish on, is that no one's ever told me to fuck off or don't come back or anything. They really haven't, you know. And you watch people who've relapsed in the rooms and they come back in, and what you always want is to see them in the rooms. You're not really interested in the detail of their relapse or anything like that. It's them who are beating themselves up about the shame and the exposure of it. The rest of us just want you in here, you know what I mean? You're just glad to see people and welcome them in. But as I say, I won't ramble on more than this, but I'll just say it's... I still feel like I've just walked through the door. I'm 66 years old. I feel better than I've ever felt in my life. It's still a horror when you look in windows, you think, I'm 23, I'm really cool. going on the tube, and suddenly there's a woman looking at me, smiling at me, you know, a very attractive woman, and I'm there and I'm smiling back. And then I realise she's looking at my son, who's sitting there. And then you have to do some sort of odds, you know. It's good aging, it's good getting older, and it's good being in your body and being adults and being in the rooms, and that's what these rooms have given me. I'll leave it there. Thanks.